Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beat and Track Podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. Today's episode, I sit down with Gary Kemp. That's right, Gary Kemp of Spandau Ballet. And it's a wonderful chat. Gary's also a podcaster, which we touch upon, I believe, at the beginning of this episode. And he makes my job so easy. He's a wonderful talker and talks with such passion about music. So this was a dream episode, and you're in for a treat, trust me. Before we get on with that episode, a few thank yous. So I'd like to thank Scroobius Pip and everybody at the Distraction Pieces Network. I'd like to thank Rob at Sony for helping facilitate this. I'd like to thank 76 for producing this podcast, and I'd like to say a big thank you to you lovely lot for listening and supporting this podcast, which you've done now for a few years, and it's been wonderful, to especially throughout lockdown, that the fact that you have supported and listened and shared and retweeted and told your pals, it's been great, and it's been a real lifeline for me during lockdown, whilst my venue's been shut, to be able to connect with some amazingly beautiful creative people and have some wonderful chats with them, and the fact that I get to share them conversations, and you know, if you get a fraction of the joy from listening as I do recording them, then yeah, everyone's a winner. So thank you. Okay, well, if you'd like to support the podcast, as I mentioned just then, we're on all the socials, so give us a like and a love and a share. And also, I have a Patreon. And so if you want to support the podcast there, then feel free to do so. I'm aware it's been a tough year and times are tough, so no pressure there. But if you do head over to patreon.com/offthebeatandtrack, then you'll find that for as little as 79p a month, you can get access to a back catalogue of 200 or so episodes that have never been released to the public. I put up lots of video episodes as well. And yeah, they're just bundles of stuff. So that's all over on the Patreon, should you wish to support the podcast there. I know why you're here, and it's not for this kind of waffle. You want the proper chat. And so, yeah, it gives me great pleasure to say, please enjoy Off the Beaten Track Podcast with Gary Kemp. Right, I've got to take a quick break in this podcast because I've got some super exciting news. Off the Beat and Track Podcast is proud to go into partnership with the Cacao Bar from Hotel Chocolat. That's right. The Cacao Bar is not a chocolate bar. It's all the best bits of a chocolate bar put into a really exciting new alcoholic range. That's right. Gin, vodka, and a beautiful range of cream liqueurs. So one of the big bonuses of this partnership is obviously I'm super thrilled to have Hotel Chocolat working with us, but they sent me a great big box of this stuff, and I'm telling you, it's amazing. Go and check it out, www.hotelchocolat.com, or over on the socials at Hotel Chocolat. But yeah, in the coming months, there's going to be opportunities for you to get involved with competitions with us, to win bottles of stuff. There's loads of exciting things coming soon, and I can't be more happy to say that this podcast is in partnership with the Cacao Bar from Hotel Chocolat. All right, let's get back to the podcast. It's Off the Beat and Track Podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network with me, Stu Whippin. Okay, we are recording. Joining me today via the means of Zoom, Gary Kemp. Hello.
Hi, Stu. How are you doing?
I'm all right. Thank you, mate.
On the other end of a podcast this time.
Yeah. Let's talk about that before we do anything else. So how did you find yourself in the realms of podcasting?
Well, the story I tell is that, you know, Guy Pratt and I, who, you know, Guy plays bass in Nick Ronson's... God, let me start again. Told you I'd just come from the gym. Let's start again.
Oh, brilliant. That was me saying Motley Hoople, wasn't it? It put Mick Ronson in your head.
Yeah.
Right, okay, start again. Okay, we are recording. Joining me today via the means of Zoom, Gary Kemp. Good morning.
Morning, Stu. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you. I'm all right. So I'm talking not only to a songwriter, which is always a joy on this podcast, but I'm talking to a fellow music podcaster as well. So before we get on to anything else, how did that come about, Gary?
Well, Guy Pratt and I mean, I've told this story before, but it is true. You know, we think we're the funniest guys on earth, you know. So touring with Nick Mason, Sourceful of Secrets, you know, we're the funniest guys on the bus, always cracking jokes with each other. You know, in the old days, someone would have said, get a room. Now they just say, get a podcast. So we meet. And we interview other... we sort of started off gently before lockdown, put a few in the bag, when Nick Mason was the first. And then as lockdown happened, you know, we found it was easier to get a hold of people over Zoom. Mm. And it's been great. You know, we're fanboys in the end. We're fans of all music. As you might tell from this list I've made up for you. Let me open the door to my dog who's growling to get out. There he goes. It's real life, isn't it, on Zoom?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Is you know, we're fanboys. We love music. My collection is, you know, you'll see today is hugely eclectic. I grew up in the 70s bouncing around between all kinds of music. Mm. You know, I'd have Bowie, obviously, and Mark Bolan, and I'd have Rory Gallagher. I'd have Stevie Marriott. I'd have Genesis. I'd have Yes. You know, I'd have Groundhogs. Well, maybe not Groundhogs. And so all of this is all stuff grist for the mill for a podcaster like myself, talking to all different genres, if you like, within rock music. And I'm loving it. It's great. It's just really great to have people on and talk to them about, you know, about their lives and music.
Absolutely. And I don't know if it's been the case for you, but certainly for me during lockdown, it's been a real nice opportunity to connect with people, and because that's obviously one of the fundamentals that we've been starved of over the last sort of year, is that kind of being able to hang out with people. And yes, at first it felt strange over Zoom, but hearing, like, getting to speak to creatives and talking about their journeys and how they put things together, it fires me up, and it's been a real lifeline, I think, to kind of keep my head where I want it to be throughout this whole sort of last year. So with that in mind, before we start talking about your song choices, Gary, how have you found the last sort of 12 months? I mean, for the listener, we're recording this at the tail end of April 21. Have you found it both as a husband and a father, and also as a creative?
Well, it's a mixed bag, like I think it is for everyone. I mean, luckily, none of us were affected by the disease. We sort of, you know, had the opportunity to hide away a bit in the country. But being thrown together with your family, I mean, you realize why schools were invented. They were, you know, because kids aren't meant to be with their parents nonstop when they're that age. You know, they need a break. They needed a break from us. We needed a break from them. And they certainly needed a break from each other because they were fighting all the time. I've got three boys. So there's a lot of that going on, kind of working out the balance of life as a family. But I took it as an opportunity because I was meant to be on tour, and then the tour got cancelled. And I'd already started work on a bunch of songs, and I was already keen to sort of finish them at some point. And I think I was sort of aiming at some point in the future, you know. But this was now a moment when I could really get it done. And I got in touch with some drummers and bass players that I needed. And we worked remotely on a record. So, and it just gave me you know, there was no excuse. You know, I'd have an afternoon when the kids were settled, and then I'd go into my studio and I'd start to work on tracks. And then I'd work with a guy called Toby Chapman, who's my co-producer on this album, and we were going backwards and forwards. And so there is this idea that actually I was finding myself able to contact more people because people were less busy. And I think creatives of any kind are used to forces of opposition coming in their way, and they just step to the left or step to the right, you know, to quote Bowie.
Yeah.
Or is that turn? That's turn to the left.
That is
it?
Turn, yeah. I mean, I guess looking through the songs that you've sent over today, the influence of Bowie, you know, it's pretty prevalent. And I'm sure it's going to feature heavily in this chat today. And so I guess let's get the playlist started. So I'm going to ask you, please, Gary, for the song with the greatest ever intro, please.
You know, this is also one of the shortest intros, funnily enough. Although intros now are out of fashion, right? You know, apparently they're out of fashion. Although I think with my latest single, Ahead of the Game, I think I've got a pretty cool intro there, and it's quite long. But the reason I did hear a program about this, and I've spoken to some songwriters who are, you know, adamant about this now, is that you forget about intros, you go straight to the chorus, because that's how you get on TikTok. What a world are we living in? You know, people are writing for TikTok.
You've preempted my question, Gary. Like, I always ask guests, and I can never quite phrase the question right. I've tried it about 280 times now, and I still can't frame it right, about that influence of how there is not allowed to be any fat on the bone anymore. It's like straight in with a chorus. And I've always wondered, like, and I'd normally ask guests, like, how has that affected your songwriting process? Because it was Martin Ware, I think, I spoke to about this. And he was saying that, no, it was Andy McCluskey. And he was saying, like, nowadays, if the vocal doesn't come in by X amount of time, you don't get mainstream radio. And so he was saying, like, Enola Gay would not get on the radio now and things like that. And I just wonder, because, you know, to use Spandau as a great example, like Gold, like the intro there is so long before the payoff comes in. And it's like, And I just find it really strange that it's now gone down to literally TikTok.
Well, it has, yeah. But, you know, Ahead of the Game has got a long intro. It's got that guitar solo. I don't know whether you know the track. You've heard it yet. But it's melodic. And I think if you're hitting people with melody straight away, that's what counts. What's not good is kind of what we call in as a musician, you know, which is feel. Just a little bit of feel. You know, just playing around on some chords, you know, that's not interesting to anybody. And the intro that I picked is so melodic. In fact, it's probably one of the most melodic parts of the entire song. It starts with a melody on a guitar, not dissimilar in that sense. It's pretty short. It's all the young dudes, right? So this beautiful sound that Mick Ralphs gets on his guitar, which you can hear is a Les Paul. You know, you can hear the plectrum scraping against the strings with the descending chords that go on in the background. Then the bend. And a bit more. And you're into the song.
Yeah.
And it's been described as the chimes of youth, which I love, right? Because it is bell-like.
Yeah.
It's like a heraldic moment of welcoming the gladiators into the arena. You know, you can imagine the heralds coming out with their trumpets and doing this. In actual fact, it's really Bachian. It's the same chords pretty much as what became Air on a G-String, which was an adaptation of Bach's, one of Bach's orchestral pieces, mm-hmm. with that descending chord, bum, 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 bum. So we know that in the West as being really a spiritual, almost church-like, religious sort of piece of music. And so it's anthemic. within a few bars, you know you're listening to an anthem.
Yeah.
And this is an anthem of youth. So it set me up as a kid. It was like this was a blast from someone beautiful on a wasteland, because that's the kind of place I lived. I lived on, in my mind, I'm living on a wasteland, and yet this sort of heraldic blast comes in, and I think that sets up the lyric of ordinary heroic kids, which is what, you know, the song's about. You know, it goes through a list of these wonderful characters that you know live in your area, that listen to T-Rex, you know, that are part of your scene, and, you know, that have spots on their faces, but are somehow greater than ordinary. And I don't think there's a better intro in rock music than All the Young Dudes. I mean, you know, it's Mick Ronson who's kind of originally, you know, he's based his sound on mixed guitar playing, exquisite guitar playing, still the biggest influence on me. I mean, the way, you know, Mick is scraping, both Micks, Mick Ronson or Mick Rouse, you know, scraping that guitar with their plectrum. I do that today. It's what I do. I always do that. And there's a sense of yearning in that guitar. There's a sense, there's heartache in that guitar. It's hugely strident. And can I go on about this anymore? I don't think I can. I think I've exhausted all the imagery that surrounds four bars.
Oh, it's a glorious, glorious song. And we haven't even touched on the vocal. The vocal is just incredible as well. I stumbled across the Freddie Mercury tribute show. It was on one of the Sky channels the other day, and I left it on, and Bowie had done Under Pressure with Annie Lennox. Then it's in Hunter, isn't it?
Yeah.
He comes out, and they just, oh, his voice is ridiculous.
And Mick Ronson plays the opening.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's very bittersweet, because it's not long before Mick died. I think it's his last performance. And I hate to say this, but he hits a bummer on that opening intro.
No way!
It doesn't sit well. You know, it's big pressure there, big pressure. We actually did it as Spandau Ballet once. We did it in somewhere. It's on the internet. You can find it, us lot doing it. And it's a song of, you know, it's a song that, you know, sits kind of, it's very Bowie. It's very of that period. You know, he offered Mott the Hoople Suffragette City originally.
Really? I did not know that.
And they turned that down. And, of course, Suffragette City ended up on the Ziggy. Well, maybe he was already on Ziggy Stardust, and he was just offering it to them as well. Because Mott had not had a very successful few years, and it looked like they were about to split up. And I think Bowie had an affection for Ian. You know, Ian wrote one of the greatest rock books, autobiographies ever, which is, you know, Diary of a Rock and Roll Star, which is still available on paperback, you know, which is, you know, about their tour to Europe, to America. So he gave them this song. I think the follow-up, he offered them a follow-up as well, which was Drive In Saturday, which they again didn't take. But, you know, they had a bunch of their own good songs by then, Roll Away the Stone, etc. But this came out, this was written at a period of, you know, Clockwork Orange was out, you know, that was, so that whole Droogs and stuff and all of those, you know, a sense, the imagery in this song is all about, you know, housing estates and the various characters that are living inside the housing estates, and not all good things, you know, the opening line, you know, is a guy considering suicide, you know, I mean, get that on the radio today. you know, people talk about how everyone's so much more open. Actually, it's much harder to get tracks played now. People are very much more sensitive now.
Yeah, sure.
So, but no, I had a brief sort of, I think Ian had a decadence in his voice that Bowie liked. And I don't know which came first. I think there was an element of, I think both of them were probably interested in the East Coast, what was going on over there in New York and factory and all of that sort of stuff. But Hoople never really matched this one after that, I don't think. You know, Roll Away the Stone was good, and, you know, on Lucci Boogie. And but anyway, you know, I'd take that intro with me. You know, if that was the last piece of music I ever heard, you know, that it may well be that intro. I saw them play live about 10 years ago at the O2, and they got back together. And you know, it's not the easiest guitar part to play, that, funnily enough. And I think, and Mick Ralphs didn't, I think he had a bit of a sloppy job on that at that night, because you know it so well, it's got to be done so perfectly. And if it isn't, you kind of get upset about it, because it's gone in a second.
Well, I'm going to ask you for track two, Gary. I'm going to take you back now and ask you for the first song you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you, please.
Well, you know, it's it depends what you mean by an emotional impact, of course. So I was talking about this the other day, actually, to my brother. The first song I ever got a kiss to, which isn't really an emotional impact, but it was certainly, you know,
it's special. Impactful.
And it's not the one I'm going to choose, was Betcha by Golly Wow by Stylistics. Mm-hmm. So that's every time I hear that, even today, you know, years later, you know, 40 odd years later, I'm still like, yeah, I can't remember who it was. but emotionally, well, I mean, all songs hit you emotionally, don't they? It's a hard one. So, you know, it could be the intro and the beginning of Metal Guru, you know, which I thought was just, you know, a powerful piece of music. But emotionally, I am going to choose a song from The Faces and that album, which I think is so brilliant, which is A Nod's As Good As a Wink. And it's the Ronnie Lane song, Debris. And the reason I choose that is, I mean, I bought that album very early on. It was one of the first albums I ever bought. And I bought albums in two different ways. I worked as a greengrocer on a Saturday, and I did some evenings as well, just around the corner from where I lived. You know, I'd go and help out the greengrocer there, so, you know, I'd get a few shillings and whatever it was then. I think new money was in, and that I could save up to buy records. I'd also beg my mum. I remember they were about $1.99 to buy an album in those days, you know. So, and she was often, you know, scraped around in her purse and found something for me. But A Nod's As Good As the Wink, I don't know why I chose that. I do, actually. Maggie May. Yeah, Maggie May was really happening. And Stay With Me was happening. And I really loved the whole look of the band. I love the way they kick footballs around on stage on top of the Pops. Mm-hmm. I just thought they had a real vibe of being in a gang. I just love the music of Stay With Me. And I love that album cover with the little models of them on it. And but this track stood out for me. Oh, by the album sleeve had a poster that came with it. And I was a very sensitive boy. I didn't want to upset my parents in any way or be embarrassed. And when I opened up this poster, it was a bunch of little Polaroids or pictures or something of the Faces backstage and in dressing rooms and, you know, at recording studios. And one of them, tiny weeny picture, had a topless woman in it.
Of course it did.
And so I destroyed the poster.
No way!
Yeah.
Or through fear that your mum might see the set of boobs on it.
Yeah. And then I would be embarrassed, or she would be embarrassed, or it would be awful, and I'd die of, you know, I'd burn up. So I destroyed the poster. I put it in the bin. Anyway, this song stands out. It's not Rod's voice, is it? It's Ronnie's voice. Mm. It's got a very London-sounding voice. He sings about a Sunday morning market. Oh, wow. Someone's singing about something I know. I met you on the debris at the Sunday morning market, you know, and it was, you were looking for a bargain. You know, we used to go to the market every Sunday morning with my mum. You know, we used to go to Chapel Market in Islington and look around, see what we could buy. You know, there'd be a pie and mash shop down there. On a Friday, we had pie and mash. It was one called Mans's. It's not there anymore. I mean, the market had a apple fritters stall. I did hear a story once that the guy who ran the apple fritters stall, and the hot fat that he made the fritters in, at the bottom was a load of sovereign rings that he would sell. You know, you could fish one out, dodgy, bent. But I don't know whether that was true. But then they'd have a sarsaparilla stall, selling, you know, those that wonderful cordial juice. You could get hot sarsaparilla and apple fritter, and you wouldn't have a pie and mash as well, unless you were really greedy. But it was a Sunday morning market. My dad also used to take me down to Brick Lane, Club Row. And, you know, in those days, you'd see all the animals. There'd be dogs in boxes. There'd be literally, you'd look in a box and there'd be a load of puppies in stuck at the bottom, and you could choose them. Or you could choose a canary or a parrot or a, you know, a snake, a monkey. I mean, it was mad. Because none of that's allowed now, quite rightly. But I knew this life he was singing about. And he was singing about it in such an emotional way. I thought you were my hero, you know. It's a very moving set of chords, and it's sung in a plaintive way by Ronnie. But it was about my life, I felt. It was about people who knew my streets, who knew my world. It wasn't American rock and roll. It wasn't Memphis, you know. This could be my street. And it really touched me emotionally, and it still does today. I put that track on, and it now, of course, in those days, it was about the moment I lived in. Now it's nostalgic, you know. Now it's about my, you know, in my head, it's my mum. I can picture her in her long coat with the holes in her pockets that she always had. I knew it had holes in her pockets because I looked in her coat pocket one day when it was hanging up. I think I was probably looking for some pennies to go and buy some sweets, and there were holes in both sides, and we were quite poor. I remember seeing my mum cry once because she couldn't afford to buy me a pair of shoes, and they'd got too small for me. So I think that this song has a lot of resonance with my own life, but set in a, you know, but with wonderful players, you know, and it stands out on this album. You listen to this album, which is great rock and roll, very kind of American slide guitars, bottlenecks, and then suddenly this London piece of London reportage.
Listen up, I've only got another new sponsor, Egg Fried. It's this super cool clothing label. And if you're into sort of skating and street art and gigging and kind of like really cool art and throwing a little bit of Asian culture and the designer's kind of weird sense of humour in the mix, then you're pretty much there with the wonderful world that is eggfried.com. Now, they do these amazing punchy kind of graphic tees, hoodies and sweatshirts, beautiful art prints, as well as this. They have a denim range, all handmade in-house, all supporting the slow fashion movement. Not only that, they've given you a discount code, 10% off when you head over to eggfried.com. Just use the code EGGSALAD, EGGSALAD, save 10%. Go and get lost in the world of Egg Fried. Also, they've got a new kids range, and it's called Small Fried, and it's super cool, super cute. And again, it's all over there in this wonderful world. Go and get involved at eggfried.com. I'm going to stay in the formative years.
Sorry, mate, I do talk a lot. I'm really apologising now.
it's beautiful. Like, I always like to ask guests, like, if they shut their eyes and heard that song now, what would they picture? And you'd done it perfectly. Right, so you're making your podcast. You're making my job very easy today, Gary. This is lovely. For track three, remaining in those formative years, a song that reminds you of your time at school, please.
Well, you know, I mean, I could have picked so many because, you know, people used to walk around in what we call the quad, right? Which is, I better describe what school I went to. So I went to a school called Dame Alice Owens, and it was in Islington. It had been in Islington since 1613, right? So it was set up by this woman for poorer kids, and it became a grammar school, and I got into this grammar school. And of course, when you go, you know, I was at a local school before then, my primary school, and I only ever met working class kids all my life, and then suddenly I'm at a grammar school and I'm meeting middle class kids, and I'm going to their house. Maybe one of the, you know, someone invited me to their house. I see books on the shelf. We didn't have books. We went to the library. You know, I see people reading big newspapers that look, you know, rather posh and discussing theatre. I went to this person's house called Jay Landesman, who was a counterculturalist. I got in there via these other, this his son Miles, and we went one day to have a jam on guitars. I must have been about 12, I guess, and on keyboards. And they were a little bit older than me. And this isn't the song I'm choosing, but one, but we actually ended up playing "Set the Controls for the Heart of the Sun," Pink Floyd. For hours and hours on our guitars and keyboards, which is funny, really, because that's the song I play now with Nick Mason, one of them. And but in the quad in our playground, so you'd have kids and they'd walk around with their vinyl sleeves as like little flags, right? So this was like a flag on a boat. This was saying, "I am the Groundhogs. I am Rory Gallagher. This is our tribe. This is your tribe." And I guess the working class kids tended to be at that point Bowie and T-Rex and Rod Stewart and the Faces. So they'd be into all of that. They'd be wearing clothes as much as they can. They could twist their, you know, do whatever they can to twist their school uniforms round into looking something like that. Maybe a tartan scarf or something. And then it was sort of on the other side of the, metaphorically on the other side of the quad, there'd be kids with Genesis albums and Yes albums and ELP albums. And I was a very aspirational kid culturally. And I was really intrigued by that kind of music. To me, that represented something more difficult musically. And I got in with a guy called Jess Bailey, who was a keyboard player. And he was a bit older than me and hung out with some sort of hippie people that worked in a music shop in Islington. Anyway, he was into Genesis. And I ended up buying Foxtrot or listening to Foxtrot. Foxtrot came into my life, this really complex, what we call prog rock album now, with Peter Gabriel at front, Phil Collins on drums, Mike Rutherford, Tony Banks, Steve Hackett. And I bought this album, and what I loved about it was that the complexity was closer to classical music. So I think prog rock comes out of middle class kids wanting to play rock and roll, but feeling rock and roll was a bit too oiky and a bit too folky in the kind of popular sense, but embracing a kind of rock classical. So going for different time signatures, quirky stuff. Foxtrot for me, which is a 28-minute track or something, yeah. It's all of side two Supper's Ready. I'm talking about Supper's Ready, which is all of side two of Foxtrot. Supper's Ready is my track, by the way.
Yeah,
I haven't already said that. It's a common word to use, but it was a journey in music. Yeah. It took me somewhere that I'd never, ever been before, musically.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm going to take a break in case you want to ask me a question.
Oh, I'm always interested as to how guests, especially sort of people you said you was, you know, culturally sort of aspirational. Like, how did you find school? Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, I did. I did enjoy school. I liked learning. I liked English. Gave me an opportunity to form bands, to play music, to do drama. I was really creative in the school. You know, I was, you know, me and a mate put together a Pinter production once. I was often, you know, lunchtime, go and see Gary Kemp play his guitar on stage with, you know, I was always doing something, you know.
Obviously, you know, you've gone on to play to, you know, hundreds of thousands of people on the biggest stages on the planet. Was you confident then?
No. I've always been, even now, you know, I'm very, very hugely nervous of performance. But there's a choice in life, isn't there? You either say, I'm so nervous, I can't do it. And that's it. You don't do it. Or you say, I'm really, really nervous, but you know what? I'm just going to force myself into this situation. And it's going to be worth it in the end, because I'm going to be happy for a few minutes on stage. And when I've got over my nerves and I'm feeling good, but afterwards I'm going to be euphoric. And it might, you know, it'll just give me something in life that isn't normal or isn't usual. So I've always battled against my fear and self-doubt and the voice on my shoulder, you know. Sorry, there's been a terrible mistake. Could you leave the building? just to kind of talk a bit more about Supper's Ready, if you don't mind.
Of course.
And why I love this track so much. And what it does represent it. So it represents me, you know, obviously formative years. It represents me reaching for something a bit more difficult, culturally aspirational. But also what I remember is it's almost religious in its construction. There's soulful moments, there's difficult moments of what you can only consider to be classical. It begins with an ordinary moment of someone crossing the living room to turn the television off, and it ends with the word Jerusalem. It ends on some higher plane. It goes from mundane reality to something that is like an 18th century painting of heaven. It has moments in there that the music is very hymn-like, and it really touched me emotionally. I didn't go to church. I don't believe, but you need something, don't you, as a kid, to push you into a higher level. And you can hear my dog. Yeah, sorry, in the background. And to push you into a higher plane. And I think I could lie on the floor and listen to this song, and I would be going somewhere. Meditatively, that was beyond anything in my reality. I just think that it still works for me today. I still listen to that today. I'm taken back to those moments of trying to learn a different musical language to the one that, you know, maybe was conventional. And there's so much richness in there. It's a tapestry. It's rich and dense, and you're finding new bits all the time. It's a real goldmine of gorgeous pieces of music that hardly ever repeat themselves. So not the kind of music I ended up making. Well, but
there's going to be something when we get on to Clubland. Then there's something I want to ask you about regarding that kind of sort of. The prog influence, but just before we move on to track four, whilst we're just discussing school, did you know what you wanted to be when you was at school?
Okay, so I went to a drama club as well, Anna Scher's club for children. You know, it was after school, and I was getting quite a few TV and film roles. I had 6 weeks off of school in my first. The first time I went to my senior school, I immediately took 6 weeks off to shoot a film, which was for Saturday Morning Pictures for the Children's Film Foundation. And I had the lead in that. And it was the 21st anniversary of the Children's Film Foundation. It got a royal premiere. And the Duchess of Kent turned up, and Film 72 turned up to interview me, right? So I'm on Film 72 in this is in 1972. And they said, do you want to be an actor when you grow up? And I said, no, I want to be a journalist. And I said that because my dad, who was a printer, had always said, if he didn't have to leave school at 15 to help his mum and dad out and become a printer, he would have loved to have been a journalist. Yeah. And I felt I was sort of saying it because that's what he wanted to be. So it was my right to try and do that. But as I, and then acting never really came into my mind. I was really into music, really into music. And at 16, I went to Anna and I said, I don't want to do any more acting now, because if I do, I need to concentrate on music. That's what I need to do now. And so I wanted to be a musician really early on. I wanted to be in a band from about, professionally, from about 1976, probably when I saw the Sex Pistols, around that whole period. And we first started forming Spandau Ballet. That was it, you know, and I sort of threw my A-levels away because, you know, I remember my economics teacher saying, you know, you've got to have something to fall back on. You're not going to be a famous pop star. And then my brother, who was working in a factory as a printer, because he left school with like one O-level. And then when he left to sort of concentrate on Spandau Ballet, before we were signed, before we were even called Spandau Ballet, my dad actually wrote a letter to his boss saying, my son wants to leave to be a pop star.
Oh, wonderful.
Yes, I knew I wanted to be in music for a long time, yeah.
Okay. Well, the last one, I guess, from the sort of the early years, Gary, I'm going to ask you for the first song you remember buying from a record shop, please.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's easy, right? Because it was Ape Man by the Kinks. So how this happened was, you know, my brother and I both worked in this greengrocer's, so we did have money. We did a paper round as well. I think it was, you know, my dad was really big on us working on Saturdays and giving a third of the money we earned to my mum for our keeping, housekeeping. So I remember earning £1.50 and giving 50p to my mum. And I think it was quite, you know, hey, my kids don't work on a Saturday. But I think my dad had an ethic that he wanted to try and instill in me. And anyway, we'd saved up a bit of money to buy a record. And it wasn't like, I think we'd watched a few Top of the Pops, maybe. I don't remember. This is definitely pre-T-Rex. This is definitely before I fell in love with Mark. And I remember just going, we dressed up to go. My dad had bought me, Budgie had been on, I think. Sometimes I get my timelines mixed up. But I know I'd got my dad to take me to Club Row Market. And he took me to a tailor's because I wanted a pair of two-tone trousers, right? And he got this tailor in Club Row to I remember going in there. It was the funniest place ever. This bloke was like a mole. It was this dark little place with his big scissors and his thick glasses. And I picked the material. It was like a blue and green tonic mohair. And we made these trousers. And then I'd begged my mum for a pair of Salatio shoes, right? Sort of like a brogue, I think, shoes. And so I wanted to be like a little suede head. And I had Blakey's on my shoes, and so did my brother. He had Blakey's. So there we are, clip-clopping down Essex Road. But a couple of geezers. I think I must have been 11 and my brother was 9.
Oh, wonderful.
And we go to Cross Street, which is up near the Angel, but it runs between Upper Street and Essex Road. And there was the record shop there. I've forgotten what it's called. I thought it was called Pop In, but then my brother told me a few years ago that that was the one in Chapel Market. And we literally didn't know what to buy, so we were just looking through the sleeves and asking him if he'd put things on. Remember this guy there, long hair, and my brother picked Tremolo's "Me and My Life," which is quite a cool record actually. Had a nice sort of slapback on the vocal. Bit Beatlesy. And I think the reason I picked Ape Man at first, because I really loved the sky blue pie label. I thought that was really cool. And love the colour of that. Sky blue's always been my favourite colour. In fact, you know, growing up, Man City were my favourite Sabutio team, even though I supported Arsenal. Anyway, I think I asked him to put it on anyway, and I took that home. And, you know, it's Ray Davis, it's the Kinks. It's a bit of a weird record. I'm not quite sure what's going on in it. I'm an ape man. He's kind of singing it in some weird sort of sounds like Caribbean accent. I'm not sure what the, it's not their best work, but it's my first single.
Okay. Well, for track five, I'm going to ask you about the song that soundtracked your years in Clubland. And I've just got, I run a club in Essex, Gary, called the Pink Toothbrush. And before it was called that, it was called Crocs. And Crocs was, you know, quite a place to be. And so I'm very, very obsessed with that because that's my club and the history there.
Didn't Depeche Mode start?
Yes.
Down there?
Yeah. Culture Club played their first show there as well.
I went there?
Yeah. In Rayleigh, in Essex. That's my little, that's my club, yeah.
Now, hang on, because I think we went there. I'm right to say Depeche played there, didn't I?
Loads, yeah.
That's right. So that's where we went. We went to Crocs because, I mean, it was a soul club as well, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Before then. But we went down like kings, right? So we'd just been on Top of the Pops with Cut Long Story Short. And then we, do you remember Steve-O? I think he was one of the managers at the time. And Alison Moyet was down there, I think I might have got that right. And anyway, we went on a sort of, oh, let's go down to Crocs and judge the competition, you know. and Pesh were playing that night. Yeah, I think it was even before they were signed. Mm. And Steve Dagger walked in, who's our manager, and Steve-O, I think, was managing them.
Yeah.
People will correct me. I know they will. He went on his, I remember he fell on his knees in front of Steve Dagger. Steve Dagger. So, you know, he's like, what? So for him, he was like the greatest manager alive. You know, this is like meeting Brian Epstein if you were Andrew Lou Golden, you know. So club music is a weird choice because I have different types of clubs. You know, they're the clubs I went to in the late sort of like 77, you know, where I'd go to the Lyceum or I'd go to Crackers. Crackers was on Wardour Street and it had a lunchtime, Friday lunchtime disco. And you'd go there from school. You'd literally jump on the bus at school, go down to Wardour, because I was just down the road at my school in Islington, get off, dance, have a Coca-Cola, go back to school. I mean, extraordinary. But you'd do that. You know, you'd maybe dance for like 25 minutes, go back. And so there's that kind of scene, you know, which would have, you know, definitely American 12 inches, you know. There was this little record shop on Hanway Street. I've forgotten what it was called now. Contempo. And, you know, people went on Saturday. I mean, not me, because I'm doing the greengrocer's job, right? but people would go down and like hang outside, and they'd be playing the imports, the disco imports that were coming in from the States, you know, on the Casablanca label or whatever it might be. And you know, they maybe only have two copies, you know. So people would like, I left that, you know, and running in and trying to get it in the queue, and you know, you just couldn't hear music any other way.
Yeah.
You know? Extraordinary, and it made music much more special, right? So there's that kind of disco American club thing. But I chose a very different record for my selection because the club that changed my life was obviously Billy's, which Steve Strange ran in Soho with Rusty Egan, you know, this young Welsh kid, Steve Strange, who was kind of, you know, inventing the bazaar, you know. I guess Bowie was our big influence. You know, this story is quite famous. Anyone who's watched the Blitz documentaries and, you know.
Wonderful. Really.
Yeah. Good. I haven't seen that one, actually. I remember getting into this club. It was full of sort of, there was a lot of fashion students and then old soul boys and some sort of ex-punks. But everyone dressed up, everyone glamorous, you know, cheap, dressed up, obviously. And the first music I heard as I went down the stairs into Billy's was Kraftwerk, and it was The Model. Mm. And it was slow. Wow. People can't dance to this, you know. I was used to 110 BPM or something.
Yeah.
And I saw these two guys dancing together, androgynous-looking guys, you know, holding hands, doing this kind of slow-motion jive thing, pulling them to one side, pulling them to the other side, spinning around. and it was exotic. It was so good. It was almost akin to that moment when I saw Bowie do Starman on Top of the Pops. You know, this was a life-changing event. You know, everyone looking, you know, it was kind of had that sort of Weimar Republic thing. You know, Cabaret was a big movie at the time. But this electronic pulse and lyrically, you know, she's a model and she's looking good. You know, this is what we all wanted to be. You know, it was in praise of posturing. And of course, everyone knows, you know, I mean, I was always sort of cross with the NME and Melody Maker because they were in complete denial of the whole soul boy movement that had happened in the 70s because to them it was too aspirational. Working class kids spending all their money on clothes, not being political. This isn't right. So the only black music that they would get into was reggae because that was cool because that was political and, you know, it was kind of black hippies. That's cool. But black soul boys, there was never a mention of those in any of the music lists. So, you know, I liked all these kids who were, you know, making the most of their lives, you know, trying to be theatrical, larger than life. And the song that's always forever for me represents that moment in my time is Kraftwerk's The Model.
And I mean, so much of that early music that was coming out of Blitz and that was obviously as a synthesizer music was evolving rapidly. Could you hear, just referencing back to the prog stuff, could you hear the kind of synth influences from some of that prog stuff? Could you hear that in what was happening there?
Yeah, I suppose so. You're right, because there's like, you know, I mean, you can't really compare it, but ELP and Yes, and, you know, these bands were using, and even, you know, the synthesizer had really permeated everywhere. I mean, you know, Stevie Wonder was using the synthesizer a lot. I think what you didn't have was that combination of dance beat and synthesizer along, you know, because dance, you know, Four on the Floor stuff that we all loved before was not really synth heavy. It was at that point, it was, you know, it was more, the keyboards were a bit more, you know, Rhodesy or something, or, you know, it was guitar orientated, bass guitar heavy, real drums, obviously. And now suddenly you've got electronic drums. That was the big difference, I think. And when Rusty started playing this German music that was electronica, that was a real difference, you know. And I think it suited this idea that we were about to go into the 1980s. You know, this is a brand new decade, and it was about to happen, and the future was here, and there was a. And also, it was quite anti-American in a way. You know, it was, you know, it was more culturally to do with Europe than it was American. So, you know, I mean, all music, you know, I can see the lines that get drawn between all different music. And obviously, someone like the electronic bands like La Dusseldorf or Tangerine Dream, or, you know, that's incredibly close to prog music.
Sure.
You know, you know, and ambient music and what Eno was doing. And then you mix that up with a groove and with some posturing like Kraftwerk were doing, and you end up being able to play it in a club.
Absolutely. I'm going to take you home for track six, and I'm going to ask you to tell me a favourite song from an artist from your home county, please.
Well, this is really tough, isn't it? Because I live in London.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like I'm living in Durham and there's about a choice of three, you know, or one. As much as I love Durham. You know, it's kind of spot for choice when you're a Londoner, aren't you? You know, just talked about the Kinks earlier. We talked about, you know, we can talk about The Who, you know, because there could easily be a track from them, those guys. I mean, The Stones, I mean, it's kind of London, isn't it? The Clash, you know. I have to say on that moment, just while I'm talking about The Clash, this is going to be controversial. I'd never go to play a Clash record. I find some of that. I really love 1977 when it came out and White Riot. I thought they were incredible, that first album. But there's something happened to that band that people love them. They're all Londoners. They're all a West London band. But I always feel like I should be picking a Clash record. And then I stumble a bit, and I don't know what that is. But anyway, I digress.
I totally agree. I totally agree. And so many people have come on here with an outpouring of adoration for like Strummer and how pivotal that band was for them, and you know, career spanning, you know, releases of. I think they're good, but I don't get it to that level.
Well, I think I had an issue with Strummer for a while, but I love the when Mick sings. I really like those songs. You know, I always think those songs are really cool. I really enjoy his work. And I saw the Clash; they knocked me out. I saw them supporting the Sex Pistols in '76, and it was the most extraordinary look I'd ever seen. You know, in the boiler suit splattered with paint. But there's just there was something about Strummer I didn't always buy, and I always felt he was a little bit. I don't know, maybe because he played in the 101ers before, you know, I mean, I don't know. I'm going to get slaughtered for this. I know I am, but we're all entitled to our...
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm on board with you.
Yeah. So anyway, there are a lot of London bands. The Who, on the other hand, I could listen to endlessly. But there are a lot of London bands. So I've got to look to Bowie, who made the London voice very, very important. And he made it important because, you know, there was a little history he was plugging into here. Obviously, there's Anthony Newley. We know that. The theatre of that. The theatre of Music Hall, you know, that Newley was looking at, you know, the London Cockney singer. Sid Barrett, you know, who was also enjoying singing in more of a London accent. I think, you know, that the Beatles helped people embrace their own accents. Mm-hmm. As opposed to singing in American. And I suppose there were lots of those people in those days, Freddie and the Dreamers, and, you know. But I'm choosing Bowie because he's singing in this song is about London. And it's about Soho, and it's about the streets that I played on. It's about people that I kind of knew. It's the London boys. You know, it's, sings about Wardour Street.
Yeah.
You know, this is where I go clubbing. You know, it's sings about taking pills in Soho. This is what I did.
Yeah.
You know, you can go the wrong way. I saw in our clubs, you know, hanging out in Soho, some people went, you know, like, didn't survive.
Yeah.
They didn't bounce out of it. You know, there was a bunch of people who did really well. You know, we all started, we were all taking drugs. We were all having a great time. We're all talking nine, you know, 10 to the dozen or whatever it is, you know, and, about how we were going to change the world, you know. Of course we were. But some of us went on and kind of did that culturally and in different ways, in film and fashion and music. But others got left behind and others got deeper into the drug thing and got destroyed. And this beautiful little theatrical piece that Bowie wrote all those years ago in the 60s, really. I don't think any song has ever summed up the pressure of young kid coming in and leaving home and, you know, trying to find danger and fun and exoticism and himself or herself in the square mile of those streets in Soho. It's a beautiful theatrical song. You know, Bowie goes from singing in that tiny little croaky voice that he sings, you know, Bright Lights, Wardour Street, into like, we're the London boys, into his full-throated, anthemic voice that he uses now and again. And of course, that wonderful, da-da-da-da-dee-da-da, it's the bells.
Yeah.
That's the bells of Bow. You know, that's what's ringing out in his voice. That's his ambition.
Yeah.
To be greater than he is. And some people do make that. And David made it.
Yeah.
Others don't. And that's why I love this song.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Perfect. So for your last song, Gary, you get to play Tastemaker. And I'm going to ask you, please, for a song that many may not know that you would like them to hear, please.
Yeah, it's by Scott Walker. It's called It's Raining Today. I wish I knew more facts on it because what I really love about this, and I might actually look it up while I'm talking to you, because it's the string part is wonderful. This came into my life a couple of years ago, a few years ago. Just heard it somewhere. Scott Walker's beautiful. He's sort of, you know, he's slightly acquired taste. You know, he has that. You know, he's a massive influence on Bowie. You know, in that sort of voice that he has, that baritone voice, and his storytelling. I mean, he started off doing really theatrical songs that were, you know, great, you know, bizarre tales of life that he would sing about with orchestration behind him. And I found him a big influence on a couple of things I was doing on my new record. There's a track on the album In Solo called In Solo. And I was trying, I used it as a bit of a template for the drama that I was trying to capture in the story in this song, you know, Richard Harris's, MacArthur Park.
Yeah.
You know, you don't get many of those sort of songs around in pop music. And Scott Walker has a lot, you know. Me see. I'm gonna look this up and I'm gonna see who did this string arrangement, because the string arrangement is so beautiful. And the reason it's so beautiful is because it's sort of every note you can imagine in the solar system is being played by one of these string players at the same time. It's rain. He's made rain out of the orchestra, and it's a rain curtain that is just covering up the background of it's almost, if you're looking at Scott on a proscenium arch stage, I see this string section as being an entire curtain that's hanging behind him. You see, I start to look up, It's Raining, and I get It's Raining Men, and that's not the track I was looking for, is it? And I just want to know who did that string arrangement, and I hope you don't mind me looking for this.
Not at all. So it's on, if I'm not mistaken, it's on Scott 3, isn't it?
Yeah, so with the one with the eye on the, on the front and himself reflected in the eye. And they call it Baroque Pop.
Wonderful.
And that kind of sums it up. Yeah. Baroque and roll. and I've never quite seen, he slips genres, you see. This is the thing with Scott Walker. He's a bit like Anthony Newley, but a bit more interesting in a way, you know, a bit more edgy, you know, and the Walker Brothers, I think they did an album sometime in the early 80s called Night Flight. And I think Eno then goes on to say that he thinks it's one of the greatest albums ever made. And it's quite an obscure little album. It's a bit more electronica involved in it. So the strings were arranged by Wally Stott. Wally Stott. Who died in 2009, English composer and conductor who became a familiar household name to BBC radio listeners in the 1950s. I see. Wally Stott became Angela Morley. That can't be right. You're going to have to edit this, aren't you, mate?
That's fine. Loving the journey.
I think this is more interesting than we think it is. Yes, I see. So Angela Morley was born under the name of Walter Wally Stott.
Wow.
Well, there we are. There's a whole story in there that's greater than the song, and I'm going to explore that when we sign off.
So we've done prog, we've done punk, we've done electronica, we've done that early kind of new wave sound.
Baroque and roll.
Baroque and roll. How do we fit yacht rock into this then, Gary?
I know. I shouldn't have said this. I this is my latest record that is this one track on the album which has a kind of I said it's a homage to yacht rock. Use the word homage and then you kind of get away with it rather than just saying it's yacht rock. I suppose it acts like, for me, yacht rock is the good bits of yacht rock are people like, Steely Dan or Todd Rundgren, right? Mm-hmm. So, there's a few other bands out there that fit into that, but it's a kind of euphoria, a euphoric melody, chord sequences, style of rhythm that is very uplifting.
It's joyous. And,
I mean, do you remember that song, Baby Come Back? Who is that by now? I can't think now, just for a second. And so joyous, yeah. And I'd sort of stumbled on these chords. And part of this album, my album, is really about looking back on my life and trying to join the dots of these different people I am. There's a track on there called Waiting for the Band, which is about being a fan and how that feeling has never left me. And it's one called I Remember You, which is about being a much stronger human being. Sharper of eye, fleet of foot, and how do I live with that now, getting older, less time in front than behind. So there's a lot of slight self-reflection in the album. And then there's a couple of pop songs, which is what I like writing. And one of them was Ahead of the Game. And I said, I said, that's probably my influence because I was looking back on a load of 70s albums that made my life, whether it's for everything from ones we've been discussing to bands like 10cc, the Wings, who I love, I want to get my backing vocals to sound like this, on this 70s record. So I just wanted to be able to make references as I listen back to my album and think that represents me growing up, and the tastes that I had then. And so along came Out of the Game, and I it's kind of yachty.
And the album's out June the 18th, is that right?
Yeah, you can pre-order now, as you do nowadays. And I'm really proud of it. I did most of it in lockdown, but it's got some great players on there. Guy Pratt plays on there, Richard Jones from The Feeling, Roger Taylor from Queen, Ash Sohn, who plays on loads of Robbie and Adele tracks. My brother plays a bit of bass on Waiting for the Band, and Toby Chapman and I do keyboards and I play guitar. It's some of the song. It's lyric really. It's an album I wrote lyric first, pretty much, and then built the music around it. And it's.
Have you always done that?
No, I only do it when I'm writing for myself. I think writing for Spando. I did it once. I did it on Through the Barricades, but I just felt I was. This album I was drawn to by writing lyrics, trying to solve some problems that I had, some thoughts that were concerning me, some issues, getting into and I try and put that down into verse. And then there's a song on there called Rumour of You, and I had three tunes for it before I chose the one that's finally on the album. And that's how it was kind of working for me, this record. It's saying that, I can't help but try and write hooks, So yeah. It's not like, it isn't a guy talking about his life ending, leaning over an acoustic guitar.
Yeah.
It's quite uplifting as well. There you go.
Wonderful. So if people want to find out about everything that's happening in the world of Gary Kemp, where's the best place to keep up to speed with you?
Just GaryKemp.com or my Instagram. This is the place. I occasionally go on Twitter and put something up, but I pretty much hate Twitter because it's just the most depressing place in the world to be.
It's a pretty bleak place.
Remember that Monty Python thing? Is this the right room for an argument? Remember that every day, right? So, so Insta Gary Kemp.com.
Wonderful, Gary. It's been an absolute joy listening to you talk today. You've made my job so easy. It was the way that you described the songs was beautiful, and yeah, I can't thank you
thank
enough.
You. You know, we both love music. That's why we're
absolutely.
Here.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Thanks ever so much, Gary.
Cheers,
all the
mate.
Best, mate. Cheers. There you go. Who'd have thought it? Spandau Ballet in my venue, watching Depeche Mode. Oh, incredible. Great. Loved it. Absolutely loved it. When I got the confirmation that Gary was going to guest, I was so happy. And it absolutely delivered. What a talker. Such passion, such love of music, and it really come across in that conversation. So huge thanks to Gary, and thanks again to you lot for listening. If this is your first time listening, then why not go and explore the back catalogues? Because you can hear me chatting to artists such as the Foo Fighters, Tommy Lee of Motley Crue, Fatboy Slim. If you like artists that kind of really stamped their name on the map in the 80s, then you can hear me talking to the likes of Andy McCluskey of OMD, Martin Ware of Human League, and Heaven 17. And go and have a rummage, because there's 300 episodes now, so there's so many ace chats to be enjoyed, so go and get stuck in, and I'll see you next time. Okay, thanks again for listening. Bye-bye.
It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whippin.